How could you fall victim to a snuff racket?
Who, if anyone, actually said, let them eat cake?
And what is the Bader-Meinhof effect?
We'll learn about odd dictionaries, common misquotes, and eponymous effects, and share our favorite language jokes with a special guest on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jessica Ferris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are joined by a special guest, Joshua Blackburn, creator of the game League of the Lexicon and the book The Language Lover's Lexipedia. And he is here to share some of the wonderful word nerdy things he has learned and challenge us to some particularly tricky questions from the game.
Thank you very much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
It's great to have you along, Joshua. I've been enjoying your work. Here's the book. You see, I've got myself a copy.
Oh, fantastic.
Flicking through it. And it's a compendium of all kinds of word nerdery. Do you know what it reminds me a lot of? Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, just
yes.
all manner of curiosity about the English language. And I could devour the whole thing. By the way, he hasn't paid us to say that. We're saying this because we enjoy the game and the book.
Tell us, you kickstarted this game, right?
It's had a bit of a crazy story. It started back in COVID lockdown, and I was stuck at home with my two boys. And they were getting their homework from school, their English homework, and it was just so boring. Instead of giving them a love of language, everything that they were getting was kind of like sucking the love out of language. It was all kind of like comprehension tests and grammar tests, and it was all so joyless. And for me, language is just endlessly fascinating. And so I started coming up with games to try and encourage them to be more curious about language. League of the Lexicon had something that I just like, I actually think there might be something here. And so I carried on working on it. We launched on Kickstarter. And in 3 weeks, it became the most successful, the most backed word game in Kickstarter history. And at that point, I was a board game publisher. I had never sought to be a board game publisher, but I was at that stage. Yeah, I appeared to be making board games about words and language.
And you've also described yourself as an accidental linguist, which is a title that I relate to somewhat.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt I've had a bit of imposter syndrome. I didn't do English at university. I'm not a linguist. I'm not a lexicographer. So I just felt like a bit of a fraud. What I have is a passion for and a fascination with and a love of language. And that really is what it's about. And actually, I really don't care that I'm not an official etymologist or lexicographer. It's just about having a love of language and a curiosity to find out more about it that really drives me.
Should we get stuck into some of those curiosities? I do want to start with just attempting to answer one or two questions from the game.
Ooh,
itself.
Lovely.
I have had a look through my own set. I reckon I answered about half of the ones I attempted.
It's correct, hard.
They're fiendish.
So it is challenging. One of the difficulties that I had writing the game is that with a game like Scrabble, it finds its own level. So if you have people that are okay at language playing each other, they'll have their game. If you have people that are super good at language, they'll have their game. But where should I pitch League of the Lexicon? And I think for me, the big thing is challenging is okay so long as it's interesting. It's as much fun finding out what you don't know as showing off what you do.
How do we do this? Maybe we just, Joshua, we just get you saying okay.
I have a selection of questions for you. I should probably keep a score as well.
Oh, yeah, do that.
And also there will be a prize to the winner.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It will be worth the winning is all I can say. Right, okay then. The first question is coming right at you, Rob.
Oh.
Yeah. What is the buckler in the word swashbuckler? Is it a sword, a shield, a short dagger, or a leather jerkin?
Oh my goodness me. Just the word swash itself makes you think of someone sort of, it's almost onomatopoeic, isn't it? Sort of swash.
Yeah.
We've done an episode about nautical etymology before, but I don't remember this being part of it. I might be wrong. I think Jess would know this.
I've definitely researched this one before, but I can't remember.
How infuriating. How infuriating.
So I guess I'll have a guess.
Yeah, yeah, get Fred.
At the sword.
Well, no, it's not that. So I'm going to add a secondary rule, which is that Jess, that whoever is still to play, can make a go for the question. But if they get it wrong, they lose a point.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Okay, remind me of the options again, the remaining options.
What is the buckler in the word swashbuckler? Sword, shield, short dagger, or a leather jerkin?
I mean, I would go with probably the shield, because a buckler is a shield in some contexts, but I don't know if it is in this one.
I'm afraid she scoops up the bonus.
Darn it.
A buckler is indeed a small shield, and the swash is interesting. You talked about the onomatopoeic sound of it. The swash is the kind of the sound of the, it's akin to the swashing of the water. So they're kind of like making a lot of noise with their shields.
A swashbuckler was originally not always a seafaring soldier. So someone perhaps could have swashy swagger and be a soldier who's just a bombastic. And
I think that's exactly it. They were swaggering people. Jess, this one's for you.
I'm ready.
Which is the only country named after a woman?
Wait, we've done this. We've done this on an episode before. It's got to be one that has to do with Elizabeth or Victoria, but it's not exactly her name. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Rob,
do you want to take a punt?
We have discussed before is the only... Well, I've discussed before anyway, is the only city named after a woman in England, which is Wolverhampton.
How's that?
Just is.
It just is. Just trust me. I'll look it up after the show.
You have to watch the episode. You have homework.
But I'm guessing you don't know the only country named after a woman.
No, I don't. I don't know it.
St. Lucia.
What?
Oh, okay. Oh, Lucia.
I was wrong.
St. Lucia.
I was thinking Jess is on the right track with her Victoria and Elizabeth.
Right. Surely it had to be like Virgin something something.
No, that's the only one. And there is only one.
To recover from that, let's just enjoy and bask in some knowledge. When I was going through the Lexipedia, I discovered a delightful section on dictionaries of interest. We're big fans of historical and editorialized dictionaries around here. We did an episode on Sam Johnson's, and we were thinking about doing an episode on Francis Grose's Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue, which is very funny.
Yeah,
what other odd dictionaries do you know of?
I think one of my favorite dictionaries is a dictionary of reduplicative words.
Ooh,
which is when you come across an unusual dictionary like that, you're just like, ooh, this is a lot of fun. It is exhaustive and fantastic. And it's honestly, it's one of those books you could just sit down and browse your way through. And it's just full of treats. That was a 20th century dictionary. I actually have it here.
Is it like wibble wobble or like?
So we have irritation, depression, and bad temper. The beezy weezies, the collie mollies, the fling flings, the hab dabs, the hansy jansies, the heebie jeebies, the hingham tringhams, the humdrums, the hummel drummels.
That's fantastic.
And it is a joyous dictionary.
But why?
To get lost in.
Why would it be useful to know that these are reduplicative?
Well, like, if like me, you're writing about reduplicative words, trust me, that's the dictionary that you want on your desk.
Or if I'm just trying to sound incredibly British.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although if you're talking about reduplication and dictionaries, there's probably a dictionary that you need to mention.
Hobson Johnson.
Absolutely. So are you guys familiar with Hobson Johnson?
Give me a second.
Oh, no, okay. You're literally about to pull it out.
no one could just have a Hobbs and Jobson on hand.
Absolutely.
Thoroughly familiar with it. Yeah, this is a copy that was bought by a friend of mine while he was traveling through India. In fact, the price is on it somewhere in rupees.
It's a real treat. So it's a really interesting example of a dictionary that is about so much more than just a pure reference work. It is a piece of history. It's a piece of sociology. It's got commentary in there. It's got narrative in there. It is just a rich and delightful reference book to get lost in. It's a dictionary of Anglo-Indian colloquial words, but it's more than Anglo-Indian. It's about a lot of other languages that have influenced English. But the joy of the book is that it is not just about here's a word, here's a definition. They do a lot of digging into the etymology. There's a lot of fascinating sources that they're citing. And it's just a brilliant read.
Yeah, it's written by proper word nerds. I mean, it was written by two men to start with, and the mantle was handed over after they died. Though I actually think one of them died before they'd even got around to publishing the thing.
Yes.
Hadn't they?
Yeah.
And we should explain the name Hobson Jobson, where that comes from.
It's a fascinating choice of name that they went for. It was not the kind of like, this is the Anglo-Indian dictionary. It's almost a piece of marketing. And the title itself was a native festal excitement that had been anglicized by British soldiers. So it was like a native festival that had the name Hobson Jobson. And they must have just, how they decided that that would be the right title for their dictionary is a curious thing.
Well, it's the cry of Yo Hassan, Yo Hussein, isn't it? Which is a Shia shout. Hussein and Hassan, they're the grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad. And yeah, it's one of these very typical British takes on a native term. But the writers of it are clearly, you know, above themselves, such sort of butchering of the languages that they talk about. So it must have been a very knowing choice to call it Hobson Jobson. Hobson, can you get a more English sounding name than Hobson?
But they clearly knew that they didn't want it to feel like just another dictionary. And it's interesting because obviously this is about the British Empire. And actually, when you read it, it hasn't aged too badly.
Yeah.
There's not too much where you're just like, oh, God, that's it. You can't say that anymore.
That's not surprising.
It is surprising. It's not too bad.
I feel as though we should read at least one definition from it. I mean, a good one to go for would be juggernaut, wouldn't it? You know,
that would be great, really typical.
Indian imports. It says, a corruption of the Sanskrit Jagannatha, Lord of the Universe, a name of Krishna worshipped as Vishnu at the famous shrine of Puri in Orissa. And then he goes on to explain how, the juggernaut was this massive statue that was pushed down the street during the processions there. And people would throw themselves underneath it in sacrifice, I suppose, not necessarily intending to die, but certainly as tribute to Vishnu himself.
That was certainly how it was described. I think that it was described somewhat salaciously by the colonial eyes.
Yeah.
But actually, it was not quite the let's all throw ourselves under the under the wagon type thing. But I mean, the joy of it, and both of you will know this, is just seeing the influence on English of words from India. I mean, in the book that I've got, we've got cash, cheese, chow, loot, thug, shampoo, pajamas, pundit, pariah, all of them from Hindi or Sanskrit or just from the area. And you just realize what an amazing influence it's had on English.
You talk about individual people in your book too, and you have a nice overview of James Hardy Vaux's life as well and his dictionary. Is that right?
James Hardy Vaux is a fascinating character. He is credited with having written the first Australian dictionary, and he wrote it whilst in prison to the prison governor And it's basically a collection of slang. He actually was a convict that had been sent over from England. He was actually holds, I think, a record for having been sent to Australia no less than 3 times for his crimes. He wrote an autobiography, and at the end of his autobiography, he had what is called this dictionary of slang and cant terms. And you can't help feeling it'd be quite nice to go out for a drink with him, but you'd really need to keep hold of your cash, because he will rob you blind, given the first opportunity. But yeah, he wrote this dictionary. He dedicated it to the governor in the hope that it might educate him to the language of the prisoners in his care.
I think they called it flash language, didn't they? This early slang out of the convict community in Australia, although they did not call themselves convicts. I don't know if this is from his dictionary or from another one, but I remember reading that they call themselves government men instead of convicts.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard that. No.
Yeah. That's definitely a thing from there.
I thought you were going to say that they call themselves guests or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's
tourists.
Apparently, the word convict didn't go down too well among the actual people who'd been sent there.
If you can dig out his autobiography, it is quite a ripping yarn, and even that has got like a whole pile of criminal language embedded in it. There's a wonderful section where he lists the various crimes.
Do you remember, Jess, we were talking about how one of the reasons why transportation and transport are used differently either side of the Atlantic
was
this practice of sending people to, for example, to Australia, which in Britain became known as transportation, which is why we're more likely to refer to public transport than public transportation.
Which
would mean moving an awful lot of people a very long way.
I found it. So he lists his various crimes and he explains what all of them are, but he's got like buzzing, dragging, sneaking, hoisting, pinching, smashing, pinching, jumping, spanking and starring, together with the kid rig, the letter racket, the order racket, and the snuff racket. And these are all kind of like little ruses and crimes that involve kind of like breaking and entering or distracting tradesmen. There's one, the snuff racket is having a handful of snuff and blowing it into somebody's face and then robbing them aren't able to see what's happening.
I don't know if they call that a racket, like it's some sort of sophisticated mob behavior.
Yeah, no, it's great. And the order, what I find interesting about this is that there's a lot of discussion at the moment about online cons and people being duped online. And then when you start reading what Vo and his colleagues were getting up to, it was exactly the same stuff. So there's one here, the order racket, which involves convincing a shopkeeper that their order that has come in is actually due to them. So it's they kind of mess around with order papers and walk off with products, or you convince the delivery boy to hand over their stuff to you rather than the place they're meant to be delivering to. And he's got like all of these scams up his sleeve, and they all have a name.
You mentioned hoisting on that list, and we've mentioned that is the verb form of the word heist, the noun heist. So they're related much in the same way that like lifting something means to steal it.
While we're trading trivia, is it time? I mean, I'm loath to say it given how I performed on the first couple of questions, but...
No, we should definitely do another question.
I promise you, these ones are really easy.
Yeah, can you take mine from the simple pile?
Skeptical.
Right, okay then. Rob. What does the mid in midwife literally mean?
Okay, I do know this one. Thank goodness.
Am I just asking you stuff you've already done episodes on?
No, it's one of these things because I live in Germany.
Indeed.
And the word the word mit in Germany means with and is directly related to the mid in midwives. Yeah, we talked about the fact that there's nothing in the word midwife that says you need to be a woman.
You're just with the wife. Fantastic. You nailed it.
Come on.
Jess.
All right.
Which disease is not made up.
Good. My medical knowledge will come in handy here.
You're looking for the real disease.
Okay.
Three of them are made up. One of them is not. Exploding head syndrome, Groat's disease, Torsic polarity syndrome, and thrips.
My gut says to go with the most ridiculous sounding one, which to me is exploding head syndrome.
Exploding head syndrome, EHS, is a condition where people hear loud explosive noises in their head. You're absolutely right.
Oh man, I feel terrible for laughing about that. That sounds terrible.
Groat's disease is from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Torsonic polarity syndrome is South Park. It's when you have a butthole on the front of your face. Yeah.
Right.
If that needed spelling out. Thrips is from Monty Python's Flying Circus.
See, that was going to be my other guess.
And that word sounds very Python-esque.
It does, yeah.
Thrips.
You have a fantastic section in the book on common misquotations, and this blew my mind because a bunch of these I fully accepted as actual quotations. And it reminded me, if I may have an anecdote here, one of the funniest language interactions I've had. I was in a Bed Bath & Beyond one time, and the lady at the checkout counter had a tattoo of the words, "Not all who wander are lost," which is a common misquotation from Lord of the Rings, particularly coming from a poem Bilbo writes about Aragorn. It's just missing one word, "Not all those who wander are lost." But I figured, even with the missing word, she would know where it came from. So I pointed to my Lord of the Rings tattoo and was like, "Hey, fellow nerd." And she was like, "What?" And I was like, "Your tattoo, it's a Lord of the Rings quote. And look, I've got a Lord of the Rings quote." And she said, and I quote, "Oh no, I got this off a website called J.K. Tolkien," and I fled.
J.K. Tolkien.
I was like, I don't know how to respond to this. I'm going to leave as soon as possible. But I would love to be mind blown by some other commonly misrepresented quotes.
What I find fascinating about misquotations is how it is so difficult to escape them. You go online and these misquotations are just shared so easily because they are things that you want somebody to have said, or it's kind of close to what somebody said, but actually the misquotation is like an edited and slightly better version of it. Or it's just like, it's completely erroneous, but it's so embedded in our popular culture that it's hard to rewrite it. So, I mean, the very famous "Let Them Eat Cake" by Marie Antoinette, for instance, is a misquotation. She certainly never said that. It was recorded by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was writing about a French princess who said something like, "Qui mange de la brioche?" Let them eat brioche. Firstly, it wasn't "let them eat cake." Secondly, the princess that he was writing about was not Marie Antoinette. She was like 6 years old at the time. It's so embedded in the narrative that you want to hear that this was French Revolution, this was Marie Antoinette, that people don't really care about it.
That one goes way, way back though, doesn't it, in terms of how long that's been misquoted. But the internet culture is obviously like a major driver of the false attribution of quotes. I think something that you were sort of hinting at, one of the drivers of it, this is just my own theory, so it's worthless, is that I think a lot of the time people are sharing the quote because it's something they want to express and they don't really care who it says said it. By having a name like Oscar Wilde, Winston Churchill, Mark Twain underneath it, it gives it some extra gravity as well.
Absolutely choking on words they did not say.
No, I think that that's it. There's another quote that I mention: "If you're going through hell, keep going," which is often credited to Winston Churchill, because that's what people want him to have said. So I don't entirely agree with you when you say people don't care who said it. It's really important that he said that rather than a pop star. It is appropriate for that person. And so it gets locked in because of that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. We're not disagreeing with each other here. I think it's just, I was saying another driver of it is that. But I'd like to mine the Churchill gold as far as like misquotations are concerned, because there's actually a section, I had a look on the International Churchill Society's website, entirely dedicated to quotes falsely attributed to Winston Churchill. And man, it's a long list that they've got there.
And you'll find similar things for Mark Twain and for Einstein. All three of them are people that have hoovered up a lot of misquotations.
Here's one that's been attributed to Churchill. Although I must say, when I first heard it, it wasn't attributed to Churchill. I think it was to Ben Jonson or someone. But it was, if you're not a liberal when you're 25, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative by the time you're 35, you have no brain. Now, why is it unlikely that Churchill said that? Well, because he was a conservative at the age of 15. Unlikely to have called himself, yeah, neither heartless nor brainless.
I don't want to be accused of being a pedant. So you don't want to be the person that says, well, actually, he didn't say whatever it is somebody said. But it kind of does matter that the right things are being accredited to the right people. But I just don't want to be the ass that tells people that that's not the right one. The truth is, I mean, it's interesting to people like us, but to people who are sharing these things online, they really couldn't care less. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, actually, you know what? I just want a picture of Albert Einstein with that quote on my Instagram feed.
The notion is it like adds credibility to what you're saying by associating it with this person that a lot of people respect for their wisdom.
There's a quote that I've got in my book, which a lot of people credit to Marilyn Monroe. Well-behaved women seldom make history. What an absolutely wonderful quote from Marilyn Monroe. Unfortunately, it was a Harvard academic who said it. The Harvard academic is very accomplished, but it's not a name people know. It's not a story that fits with what people are trying to communicate by using that quote. So even if everybody knew that it was this Harvard academic, I think that they carry on citing Marilyn Monroe because that's the story they want to tell.
Similarly, Harriet Tubman is often said to have said a lot of things about freedom that she didn't say. And she didn't say that much. She was not super known for being very verbose. It is well-intended to want to put quotes about freedom in her mouth because she was such an important person for having enacted all the things that she did. So, you know, I certainly understand the impulse.
In your book, one of the common misquotations that you mentioned is that, and I think everyone thinks this, in Snow White, Wicked, was he, stepmother?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
The evil queen.
Says, mirror, mirror on the wall. But she doesn't.
But she doesn't.
She doesn't say mirror, mirror on the wall. That's amazing.
She says magic mirror on the wall.
Got to rewatch.
So I think this is an example. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but this is a sort of collective misremembering that there is a name for. And I think this leads us on to another section in your book, which is eponymous effects. The effect I'm thinking of is the Mandela effect, where, you know, we all seem to have collectively forgotten or misremembered something that happened. I believe it's named after Nelson Mandela because everyone thought he was already dead or something. Can you remember what that is?
Several times in a row, yes.
I believe that people had remembered him die and remembered his funeral. The more they talked about it, the more they collectively remembered it. Yes. So you could, and you're quite right. The quotations are a terrific example of that, where people are just like absolutely sure that that's what was said, or that's absolutely sure that that's the thing that happened.
The one that gets me is the Fruit of the Loom logo not having a cornucopia in it. And then the Berenstain Bears being the Berenstain Bears.
One of my favorite eponymous effects is the Bader-Meinhof effect.
Absolutely.
Which not only do I experience the whole time, but I experienced it almost immediately I learned about the Bader-Meinhof effect. And the Bader-Meinhof effect is that when you discover a word or an idea or a fact for the first time, according to this effect, you are likely to hear of it again, I think, within within a week. So if you have that thing where you've learned a strange word and then all of a sudden everybody seems to be using that word, you're just like, wow.
This subject really does eat itself, doesn't it? Because yeah. I think I have had the Baader-Meinhof effect about the Mandela effect and about the Dunning-Kruger effect. I hear about those things, then everyone's talking about them. And I don't know if that is because these terms are zeitgeisty or whether or not there is some sort of phenomenon that just means I'm noticing it, but people are saying it exactly as much as they were before.
Obviously, there's a lot of eponymous effects that aren't particularly interesting. It's true, there are some just like delve deep into physics. I could give you an eponymous effect and you'd be like, yeah, that sounds kind of like useful, I suppose. But I do love the ones that seem to nail something that's got a profundity to it. The other one that I'm a big fan of is the Streisand effect, which I'm sure people will be familiar with, which is when you make an effort to hide something, the effort itself actually reveals it more.
And what was the story behind that that involved Barbara Streisand?
I believe that there was a photograph of her house that was going to be revealed in a aerial photo that was going to be seen by next to nobody. But she was determined that her beachfront property should not be seen by anybody. So she proceeded to take legal action to stop the photograph being seen. And in the process of that legal action, so shone the spotlight onto this photo of her house that everybody saw it. So it's kind of like law of unintended consequences there.
In the interest of revealing the meaning behind the name, we didn't mention that the Baader-Meinhof effect is named after the West German militant organization called the Baader-Meinhof Group, which followed journalist Terry Mullen around shortly after he had heard of them and then became...
They didn't literally follow him around, did they?
Hopefully not.
The concept of them followed him around. Right.
It would have been quite funny, though. It's like, who's that behind you? It's the bloody Baader-Meinhof gang. They literally follow me everywhere. It's ridiculous.
But only since I heard who they were.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Speaking of funny, I want to do some jokes.
Oh, yes.
There's some good ones in your book, but I also think we should take the opportunity to just try out a couple of more questions and give me a chance to try and redeem some points.
Right. Okay. I'll see what I can do. Okay, then. U.S. Senator Jake Garn has given his name to the Garn scale. It was the eponymous effects thing that brought me here. What unlikely quality does it measure? A. Reputational harm following a scandal. B. Speech length. C. The greying of one's hair. Or D. Motion sickness.
Okay, I'm going to go for speech length.
Jess, you want to jump in? Do you want to gamble?
That was going to be my guess too, but hang on. It's graying hair.
Reputational harm, speech length, graying of one's hair, or motion sickness.
I'm going to go with reputational harm.
It is motion sickness.
What?
I know, it's quite crazy. So Garn was the first sitting US senator to fly into space. And he experienced such massive motion sickness that he gave his name, or his name was taken, for the scale to measure astronaut space sickness.
Oh my goodness. I'm glad I was not in that spacecraft.
Is it how sick you feel, or how much you produce is what I'm worried about?
I'm assuming it's how sick you feel. I don't think it's based on volume.
Okay.
If that's what you're guessing at.
Yeah, it was.
All right, hit us with another.
Jess, I'm going to give you a challenging one. I think you've had it too easy.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we're going back into 19th century. To pingle is to eat without what? Pingle. Eat without cutlery. Eat without chewing. Eat without using your hands. Or eat without an appetite.
I'm going to go without appetite.
Ah, goddamn, she's good, Rob. The question is just bouncing off her.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're quite right. And it is the onomatopoeic sound of it.
Yeah, it's like...
Kind of like eating daintily or pickily.
Oh, I love that. That's nice. And I think it's the L-E ending is usually a diminutive, right?
Stop tingling with your food.
Exactly.
Is the kind of thing we need to hear more of.
But what's nice, I'd like to say, as the clear loser of this whole process, is that getting the questions wrong means I've just learned a whole load of things, which is the fun, which I think is what you're going for with the sort of the level of difficulty with these questions, right? I mean, that's the fun of it.
They should be questions that you can reasonably grapple with, but the experience of getting it wrong is offset by the pleasure of finding something out.
And the only reason I've gotten the ones that I have is based off deduction, not necessarily having known the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the joys of language, is that there is an awful lot that you can work out, even if you don't know precisely what that word is.
Should we finish with some jokes?
I think so.
End on a light note. Bring my mood back up.
So there are a number of jokes in your book, Joshua. And Rob, did you bring any jokes too?
I've got a couple.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
In my book, I've split them between jokes for linguists, jokes for grammar enthusiasts, and jokes for everyone else.
All right. Hit us with one of those.
Okay. So my favorite linguist joke is, I used to think I was the father of structural linguistics, but now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, you have to see that one written down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very nerdy joke.
So sure being the founder of structural linguistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
I like that one. I'm going to steal one of yours that I found really funny. Too many people worry about correct grammar. I couldn't care fewer.
Oh, that's very funny.
Actually, there's one that's not in the book that I'm a big fan of. Thanks for teaching me the meaning of plethora. It means a lot.
Hey. Oh, yeah. I'm going to use that one.
Funny enough, in one of our anatomy episodes, the one on the four humors, we discovered that word is actually kind of disgusting. It was originally a word for a disease of some kind where you had too much of a given humor.
Jess, tell us your favorite joke.
All right. So I have a batch of them. I'm sorry. Back in the day, I produced a series of videos on TikTok called where you're positioned in a room called or a bar called the Tipsy Grammarian, and I am the bartender. So I'm going to go through a couple of these, and I won't bore you with all of them. But the notion is, welcome to the Tipsy Grammarian. It's really nice to see you. Oh, yeah, we get all sorts here. Why, just last night, a whole group of adjectives walked in. They were interesting, creative, talkative, energetic, friendly, and a lot of fun. It did get a bit tense when the past, present, and future walked in right around the same time. The past has a history of taking action. The present reacts in the moment, and you never know what the future holds. But after a few minutes, they were conjugating over beers and having a great time. And then last week, I noticed this shady looking fellow walking up to one of my other patrons, and he starts muttering things like outside, under, to, around, behind, before, in, above, after, beyond. And I had to ask him to leave because I just can't have people prepositioning the other guests. I won't bore you.
Did you have to decline? There you go.
I have to kick out the prepositions before closing time because ending with a preposition is something up with which we must not put.
Hey, I was going to mention that one in the Churchill quotes because I think he possibly did say something along those lines, but he also may not have done, right?
I'm going to add one more because I do laugh at it. What's the first rule of synonym club? You don't talk about, utter, mention, discuss, or gossip about synonym club. Very good.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Joshua. This has been a wonderful laugh. And thanks a lot for writing the Language Lovers Lexipedia for us language lovers. It's an enjoyable read.
And making this wonderful game.
Well, look, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I mean, it's both the book and the game and this show and the stuff that you guys do. It's all about just being curious about and loving words and language. And it's great to be able to talk about it with you.
This has been a lot of fun. We'll see you next time
on another Words Unraveled.